From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Novelist E.L. Doctorow puts historical figures into fictional settings. He did it in Ragtime, and he does it in his new novel, Billy Bathgate, about a teenager who falls in with gangster Dutch Schultz. Coming up, Doctorow explains why he mixes history and fiction. Also today, anchorman Robert McNeil takes a break from talking about the news and talks to us about language, the subject of his new memoir, Wordstruck. Rock historian Ed Ward takes a listen to some of the early blues musicians on Sun Records before the label became famous by recording Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Carl Perkins. And book critic John Leonard reviews Somoza Falling, a study of America's response to the fall of the Nicaraguan dictator. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. In the novels of E.L. Doctorow, historical figures and fictional characters inhabit the same stories. In his best-known book, Ragtime, Freud, Emma Goldman, Henry Ford, and Harry Houdini make appearances. Dutch Schultz is one of the main characters in Doctorow's new novel, Billy Bathgate. Billy is a teenager from the Bronx who works for the famed gangster. The novel is set in New York in 1935. Ann Tyler reviewed the book for the New York Times and said Billy was a wonderful new addition to the ranks of American boy heroes. She described Doctorow as serving as a sort of human time machine, carrying his readers back to the days of the Wild West in Welcome to Hard Times, to the early 20th century in Ragtime, and to the 1930s in Loon Lake, World's Fair, and now Billy Bathgate. Three of Doctorow's novels have been made into films, Welcome to Hard Times, Ragtime, and The Book of Daniel, which was loosely based on the lives of the children of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. I asked E.L. Doctorow to read the opening of his new novel, Billy Bathgate.
Okay, the very first sentence I wrote in Billy Bathgate is the first sentence that appears in the book, and it actually delivered the character of Billy to me. He was sort of built into the diction and the syntax, and even the rhythm of the sentence gave me the way he breathed. Billy is a 15-year-old boy in the Bronx in the 1930s who attaches himself to the great Dutch Schultz, the Prohibition and post-Prohibition New York gangster killer. And the book opens with Billy leaping aboard a tugboat where Mr. Schultz is taking one of his henchmen, Bo Weinberg, en route to a ritual drowning in New York Harbor. And this is the way the book begins. He had to have planned it, because when we drove onto the dock, the boat was there and the engine was running, and you could see the water churning up phosphorescence in the river, which was the only light there was because there was no moon nor no electric light either in the shack where the dockmaster should have been sitting, nor on the boat itself, and certainly not from the car. Yet everyone knew where everything was, and when the big Packard came down the ramp, Mickey the driver braked it so that the wheels hardly rattled the boards. And when he pulled up alongside the gangway, the doors were already open, and they hustled Bo and the girl upside before they even made a shadow in all that darkness. And there was no resistance. I saw a movement of black bulk, that was all. And all I heard was maybe the sound someone makes who is frightened and has a hand not his own over his mouth. The doors slammed, and the car was humming and gone, and the boat was already opening up water between itself and the slip before a thin minute had passed. Nobody said not to, so I jumped aboard and stood at the rail, frightened, as you might expect, but a capable boy, he had said that himself, a capable boy, capable of learning, and I see now, capable of adoring, worshipping, that rudeness of power of which he was a greater student than anybody, oh, and that menace of him where it might be all over for anyone in his sight from one instant to the next. That was what it all turned on. It was why I was there. It was why I was thrilled to be judged so by him as a capable boy. The danger, he really was a maniac. Besides, I had that self-assurance of the very young, which was in this case the simple presumption I could get away when I would, any time I wanted. I could outrun him, outrun his rage or the rage of his understanding and the reach of his domain, because I could climb fences and hustle down alleys and jump fire escapes and dance along the roof parapets of all the tenements of the world if it came to that. I was capable, I knew it before he did, although he gave me more than confirmation when he said it, he made me his. But anyway, I wasn't thinking of any of this at the time. It was just something I had in me if I could use if I had to. Not even an idea, but an instinct waiting in my brain in case I ever needed it. Or else, why would I have leapt lightly over the rail as the phosphorescent water widened under me, to stand and watch from the deck as the land withdrew and a wind from the black night of water blew across my eyes, and the island of lights rose up before me as if it were a giant ocean liner sailing past and leaving me stranded with the big, murdering gangsters of my life and times.
And that's E.L. Doctorow reading from his new novel, Billy Bathgate. Now, you said the voice came to you with that first sentence. And when I opened your book, the first thing I thought was how different this voice was from the usual staccato, hard-boiled style associated with crime writing and, you know, with gangster figures in American fiction.
Well, I don't think of this as crime writing. And I've never been a particularly fond of the so-called hard-boiled school of work. I've never been that much interested in crime fiction or true crime, nor have I followed the culture of professional criminals in the papers. I think of this as the story of a young man's sentimental education. It's a kind of Bildungsroman. He's a bright, enterprising kid, the ideal. He's curious, he's energetic, he's a lot of wonder for the world. It's just that it's the underworld that he's attached to.
Well, you seem to be very interested in his interest and his attraction to evil and to power.
Well, we all are, I think. We're all attracted to the disreputable. And it counts, I suppose, in part for the tremendous pumping out of stories of criminals, renegades, and the otherwise lawless that we get all the time. There's something atavistic in us that admires rule breakers, transgressors. The more we ourselves are law-abiding and respectable, the more fiercely burns that little light of sneaking admiration for the truly monumental criminal.
Did you have that sneaking admiration for the criminal when you were growing up?
I suppose I must have, in a kind of fearful way. Of course, in those days, criminals were very much more compartmentalized than they are now. They had their place. They killed each other, and not you. If you just stayed out of their way and you didn't try to compete with them, you were relatively safe and could observe their comings and goings and drownings and killings with some impunity. Now there's some question, some blurring of those lines, I think. It's not quite as clear today in the 1980s who is exactly criminal and who isn't.
Yeah, and so much of the crime is random.
Random crime and also the kind of crime in which ethical standards are not as visible anymore, so that there's a lot of secrecy in this country. We've had occasions of public officials who've been supposed or sworn to uphold the law who have, in fact, broken it. And all that kind of thing just leeches it away. It gives you almost a wish for the good old days when a crook was a crook and everyone else wasn't.
Why did you choose Dutch Schultz as the gangster that the main character in your novel apprentices himself to?
That's an interesting question. I think because he was a New York criminal, and I felt a little more comfortable with him. He was also had a more mythical presence in my mind than some of the others. Dutch Schultz was not his real name, you know. His real name was Arthur Fliegenheimer. But he took the name Dutch Schultz because he was such a tough kid. It was almost given to him as an honor by his gang, because he got through reform school in such a feisty way. So he took on the name Dutch Schultz, which was the name of an earlier criminal in the turn of the century. And the name stuck. He later came to regret it, saying that if he'd kept with his original name, he wouldn't have gotten as much attention and therefore into as much difficulty, but that the name Dutch Schultz fit the headlines as the name Arthur Fliegenheimer couldn't. And so that was his error.
Was he Jewish?
He was.
Did that figure into your selecting him as the main gangster?
No, I don't think so. I think it may have been something as simple as that I liked the sound of the name, the sound, Dutch Schultz. It had a kind of a primeval ring in my mind, I think.
Were there stories about him in the Bronx neighborhood where you grew up, or was he reputed to own any businesses or have any front operations there?
Well, Billy is seen early in the book when he goes back to tell about his first connection with Schultz, hanging around one of Dutch Schultz's beer drops, a place, a sort of a warehouse for the awful green beer he was selling or foisting on the speakeasies and then on the bars after the repeal of Prohibition. And the fact that the beer drop is in the neighborhood confers upon the neighborhood a certain kind of distinction, which the young boys like. It gives them a sense of place, a sense of bearing or position in the world that they might not otherwise have. I myself was only 4 years old when Dutch Schultz died. He was killed in 1935. And I don't think any of that actually came through to me. But obviously the name Dutch Schultz and general idea of his rather fast, meteoric, and violent career was part of the folklore of New York in the 1930s.
E.L. Doctorow is my guest, and we're talking about his new novel, Billy Bathgate. One of the central incidents of the new novel is a ritual murder in which one of Schultz's henchmen is killed by getting cement overshoes and getting drowned in the ocean. And you write, a ritual death tampers with the universe. I think this idea of the ritual death was something of great interest to you in planning this novel?
Well, it certainly, the book began with an image in my mind of men in tuxedos in black tie on a tugboat. And for the longest time, I didn't know what it meant or why I was thinking of it. And then I realized that they had to be criminals, and that one of them was going to kill the other. And that's really the genesis of the entire book. That's the way it began for me. So this was a crucial scene, a very seminal scene, and the nature of the ritual, the sort of sad necessity of it sort of seeps through the entire occasion and makes it quite horrifying. And I guess something about that appealed to me as a writer.
Let me ask you to read another short excerpt from Billy Bathgate. And this is Billy talking about what it feels like to hold a gun for the first time.
Yes, this comes later. He begins as a insinuates himself into the gang, attaches himself to Dutch Schultz, gets his attention, and then becomes kind of mascot, good luck charm. And gradually works his way up into sort of an apprentice kind of person in the gang, and goes beyond that later. But at this point, they're up in the country, and he's given instruction in the firing of a gun, taken to a local police firing range where Dutch Schultz and his men have set up firing privileges. And Billy says in this point, I will never forget how it felt to hold a loaded gun for the first time and lift it and fire it. The scare of its animate kick up the bone of your arm. You're empowered, there's no question about it. It's an investiture like knighthood. And even though you didn't invent it or design it or tool it, the credit is yours because it's in your hand. You don't even have to know how it works. The credit is all yours. With the slightest squeeze of your finger, a hole appears in a piece of paper 60 feet away. And how can you not be impressed with yourself? How can you not love this coiled and sprung causation? I was awed. I was thrilled. The thing is, guns come alive when you fire them. They move. I hadn't realized that.
Did you go to a shooting range or anything before writing this and hold a gun in your hand so you have a sense of the physical sensation you were trying to describe?
No. No, I don't. I've never fired a pistol. As a soldier in the army, I fired rifles, which do have a kick, a sort of a different kind. But this, the thing about writing is that that you use your imagination a good deal of the time and can usually work out things by thinking about them and imagining them. That's the whole game, to get into people's skins, to pretend to be someone you're not, to have experiences you've never had, and to represent them truly, to render them so that questions like this are asked of you.
Several critics who loved your new novel mentioned that in the first-person narrative of Billy, who's 15 or 16 in the novel, that he uses some words that it's kind of hard to believe he'd have access to, words like empowered and investiture, which were in the reading that you just gave. How did you think that through, about what kind of language to give him, especially with these like bigger words and more?
Well, I must have understood he was smart as a whip. He's a something of a rhapsodist, too. I mean, part of his being is his power to celebrate that, even things even that repel him and make him fearful. He seems to take all of life into himself and embrace it. The capacity for wonder and rhapsody that is reflected in these nice looping long sentences he comes up with. We do learn at a certain crucial strategic point that Billy has used his criminal earnings to get himself through a very advanced high school in New York called Townsend Harris High School, and then into an Ivy League college, which he decides not to name, because in his adulthood, when he's writing this book, he has a certain renown, and he doesn't want to be identified. He's rather mysterious, as it turns out. And possibly as an alumnus of whatever Ivy League college it is, he doesn't want to pin the rap on them.
Well, I want to talk with you more about Billy Bathgate and your other work, but first we're going to take a short break. Writer E.L. Doctorow is my guest, and we'll be back after this. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is E.L. Doctorow, whose novels include Ragtime, The Book of Daniel, and World's Fair. His new novel is called Billy Bathgate. Billy Bathgate continues in the tradition, if you'll pardon that word, that you've established in your novels of combining fictional and real historical figures. What is the resonance that you think you can get from a novel by combining those two together?
I don't really know. It's just something that sort of happened. I didn't begin with any aesthetic theory. I think I've since been forced to try to describe or defend this practice many times. I think what I'm doing is dealing with in the case of historically verifiable characters, is I'm dealing with the fictions they themselves made of their lives, the extent that they made themselves public and promulgated a myth about themselves, as Dutch Schultz did, as J.P. Morgan did, as Emma Goldman did in Ragtime. You begin with the fictions people create about themselves, and then they're in your realm, you see. And it's quite valid for you to deal with them and take off from that point.
How did you start doing it? How did the idea first come to you?
I don't know when it came to me or how it came to me. I suppose a good scholar who had the interest and thought it was worthwhile could go back through the books and pick out the first moment where a historical character appears in some kind of fictional guise. I do recall a moment in the Book of Daniel where he speculates about the character of Woodrow Wilson, which might have given me this tone of mock historical chronicle that I was able to use in Ragtime. I'm not sure of that, though. It may have been earlier. It's hard to know. You know, it's just as Satchel Paige says, it applies to writers, too. You don't look back.
You know, it's the kind of thing you probably see done badly a lot. you know, even on miniseries, figures from the past are combined with fictional characters, and you end up with a kind of hodgepodge of history. Do you ever feel that people who do this kind of thing less well point to you as a defense for what they're practicing?
Well, I suppose all's fair in love and art. I mean, I don't feel I have to defend the miniseries.
Uh-huh.
I also know that novelists have been doing this forever. I mean, Napoleon is in War and Peace. Dumas, a great favorite of mine as a boy, the Cardinal Richelieu is a character in, what is it, The Count of Monte Cristo, The Three Musketeers. I mean, it seems to me the point about fiction is it wades right in. It's not a pure form. It's not as pure as music, for instance, which has no words at all. It really mucks about in life. It intrudes in life, in history, in... It uses every available kind of data that we have. It uses intuition. It uses fantasy. It uses dream work. It uses history. It uses autobiography. It's all a great big melange of data. And I think the justification for any work is not what theory it uses, but how good the particular book is. I do know that when Ragtime first came out, a lot of people said, well, he can't do this, it's not allowable. Yet writers now sort of routinely base novels on factual, historically verifiable figures. Nobody says a thing about it. So maybe this idea of the strict demarcation between the fictional and the non-fictional is breaking down a little bit, which is probably all to the good, because... We all compose our lives every day, every minute of the waking and sleeping, and I don't think that fiction writers should be the only ones to take the rap for that.
Most of your fiction has been set in the past. Do you feel that it's not your calling to write too much in the present?
No, I think I'm always writing about the present.
But through the past?
Through the past, but I just may be a little slower than everybody else.
In what?
Well, I'm trying to catch up. You see, I'm running a few decades behind.
Right, okay. You are still a board member of PEN, the International Writers Organization?
Yes, I am.
Why has it been important for you? You've been outspoken on First Amendment issues in this country and on free speech issues in on behalf of writers in other countries as well. Why has that been important to you?
Well, I mean, what is the alternative? The alternative is repression and tyranny and the absence of thought, the absence of life. I think that any writer has to decide at a certain point to commit a certain amount of his time, his effort to this very basic, elementary insistence that such and such a writer shouldn't be in prison, and such a writer should be allowed back to his own country. Such and such a writer shouldn't be tortured, and certainly not have to be in hiding with a death threat on his head. We see all forms of censorship everywhere, all around the world. It's really quite appalling. And people who live by the word seem to me to have a certain obligation to simply point this out and say it's wrong.
I'm sure you've asked yourself what, if anything, you as a writer could do to speak out. In defense of Salman Rushdie, do you feel helpless, or that there's something that you can do?
Well, we have done something. Any time our opinion's asked or we're asked to speak about this, we do. We had a really good rally a couple of weeks ago in New York. Thousands of people showed up in the streets trying to get into it. Simply to speak of these things and publicize them is what you must do. I'm beginning to have a little bit of hope for Rushdie in that, as Margaret Atwood pointed out, he's really more valuable now alive than he would be dead in political terms. And this may be an eventual way out through the slow turnings of the diplomatic mills. At least I hope so.
Have you ever been afraid to speak or write your own truth?
You're always afraid. I mean, fear is one of the things you have to deal with. The fear of revelation, the fear of self-exposure, the fear of talking out of turn, the fear of offending those around you who may see themselves in your work. These are all the conditions you begin with, and part of becoming a writer is learning to deal with that fear, learning courage, learning the peculiar life of self-revelation. The interesting thing is that when you don't have that fear, you don't have, on the other hand, the feeling of transgression that you need to do anything that's really good. So, my God, I shouldn't be saying this. This is really, really breaking a rule here. I'm really doing something I shouldn't do. So when you have that feeling, which is a bit fearful, and that you plod on through, that usually your best work is accomplished.
There's the fear of embarrassment, you know, that you'll write something that won't be liked or that will reveal something about yourself that you won't want revealed. And then the fear of imprisonment, torture, or death. Has it given, do you think it's given writers more courage to watch writers in other countries who have to brave so much to just write what it is that they're writing?
Well, we are very privileged here, of course. We're not physically in danger.
Weren't you one of the writers who was monitored by the FBI back in the 70s?
Oh, yes, but that was a great honor, you see. That to have a file in the FBI is one of the credentials for achievement. It's like the honor roll of American writing. But essentially, nothing comes of that, and I think they've stopped that now. But it's a great privilege to be on the same list with everyone from Theodore Dreiser and Faulkner and Hemingway and Catherine Ann Porter to all the way up to Truman Capote. I mean, it's a wonderful group of names to be attached to. It's kind of literary criticism the FBI does. I'm talking about like the Czech writer Vaclav Havel, who's just put back in prison on some pretext, or writers in Korea or Indonesia, or even in England now, there's the tendency to constrict, to create more draconian rules of governmental censorship seems to be on the increase. It's rather alarming. But in this country, I think writers are abused mostly by the censoring of their work, the withdrawal of books from school libraries on the local levels. The book becomes an offense to this or that group of individuals, and the rest of the community is deprived of reading it. That's the kind of danger most of us are in this country. On the other hand, we're all aware, I think, now this Rushdie thing has given us sense of the world community of writers as nothing else quite has. And that's extremely valuable, I think.
Well, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
My guest has been E.L. Doctorow. His new book, Billy Bathgate, is published by Random House, and his other books include Ragtime and The Book of Daniel. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with writer and poet Margaret Randall. Throughout the 60s and 70s, she lived throughout South and Central America, working as a midwife and writing about the lives of women in those countries. She became a Mexican citizen in 1967, and since she returned to the States in 1984, the Immigration and Naturalization Service has been challenging her right to remain here. That case is still in the courts. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Robert McNeil of the McNeil Lehrer NewsHour has written a memoir about his lifelong fascination with language. Coming up, he tells us how working as a broadcaster in Canada, England, and the United States has affected his own use of the English language. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles the early years of Sun Records and the man who started it all, Sam Phillips. And book critic John Leonard reviews Somoza Falling by Anthony Lake. It's a study of America's response to the fall of the Nicaraguan dictator. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. The government today temporarily banned the import of semi-automatic assault weapons. Drug Policy Chief William Bennett announced the ban after meeting with Treasury Secretary Nicholas Brady. Law enforcement officials have noted that assault weapons are the guns of choice for drug dealers and other criminals. The import ban is temporary. The government will review claims that some of the weapons qualify for sporting activities. Former National Security Advisor Robert McFarlane erupted in an emotional outburst today in the criminal trial of Oliver North. McFarlane began shouting when prosecutors accused him of lying to Congress the day before he tried to commit suicide. NPR's Nina Totenberg has details.
McFarlane has pleaded guilty to misleading Congress in 1985, but today prosecutor John Kecker produced a 1987 letter few had known about. The letter was addressed to Congressman Lee Hamilton, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. McFarlane wrote it on February 8, 1987, the day before he tried to commit suicide. It said in part that a foreign national had given $5 million to the Contras after a meeting with McFarlane. "I did not solicit the offer," wrote McFarlane. "I have no knowledge as to the amount the individual donated. It was from his own wealth and not from any government." In fact, as Prosecutor Kecker pointed out, when McFarlane wrote the letter, he knew the contribution had been from the Saudi Arabian government and that the amount was in the neighborhood of $32 million. Looking at McFarlane, Kecker said of the letter, "This is just complete nonsense, isn't it?" McFarlane flushed, his voice trembled, and he began to shout. "In my state of mind, the day before I tried to take my life, I was acknowledging my participation in third country contributions." Prosecutor Kecker, "You said in your letter it was an individual contribution, not a country." McFarlane, still shouting, "I think you're right. That was a gloss." I'm Nina Totenberg at the Federal Courthouse in Washington.
The Senate Armed Services Committee opened hearings on President Bush's nomination of Richard Cheney as defense secretary. Lawmakers promised swift action on the nomination and today quizzed Cheney about arms control and changes in the Soviet Union. NPR's David Malpas has more.
Congressman Cheney said at first he was skeptical about Gorbachev's commitment to reform Soviet society, but he's persuaded now, although he still doubts Gorbachev will meet with success. And he cautioned that it would be a great mistake for the U.S. to reduce its military capabilities on the hope that the danger has lessened. Gorbachev could be replaced, he said. What about the unilateral troop reductions in Europe that Gorbachev has ordered, senators asked? How should the West respond? Cautiously, Cheney said, we should not fall into the trap of responding to the offer of the week from the Soviets, but rather set our own agenda after a thorough review, Cheney said. On another issue, that of his knowledge of defense matters, Cheney admitted there are gaps in his defense expertise, but he said no one arrives with perfect credentials. Running the Pentagon requires teamwork, he said. I'll be the quarterback, but I'll need a lot of tackles and guards to help. I'm David Malpas at the Capitol.
A Lebanese militiaman faces life imprisonment on his hijacking conviction today in Washington. Fawaz Yunus is the first person arrested under laws asserting U.S. jurisdiction over the taking of American hostages abroad. He was accused in the 1985 hijacking of a Royal Jordanian airliner with two Americans aboard. He claimed he was acting under orders from the Lebanese Amal militia. The planned five-day shuttle mission may be cut short because of a faulty hydrogen tank on board the Discovery. Flight Director Granville Pennington told reporters that engineers are still trying to figure out why the tank was showing unusual pressure readings, but he said the crew is in no danger. While the engineers study the tank problem, the shuttle crew has been ordered to turn off unnecessary lights and a spare computer to conserve energy. Stock prices finished mixed today in trading on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was unchanged, closing at 2306.25. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The burning energy behind the successful Memphis rockabilly label Sun Records was a man named Sam Phillips. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward explores Phillips' early producing days and the pre-rockabilly Sun.
When people mention Sun Records, the immediate association is, yeah, the greatest rockabilly label of all time, the place where Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis and Carl Perkins and many more got their start. What most people don't realize is that Sam Phillips, the man who ran Sun and the studio where all those people recorded, would never have made it to 1954 to record Elvis if it hadn't been for all the blues he recorded there earlier. Phillips had started as a disc jockey at various Memphis stations, and it was there that he noticed something. The Negroes had no place to record in the South, he told an interviewer much later. They had to go up to Chicago or New York to get on record, and even the most successful of the local entertainers had a hard time doing that. Sam noticed that Saul and Jules Beharie, who owned the successful L.A. label Modern, were recording Memphis blues artists in garages. So he scraped together enough money to lease a small building at 706 Union Avenue for $150 a month, and soon he was making records for the Beharie brothers in a clean, modern studio.
Be careful what you're driving, man. That Cadillac may get away. You better be careful. Down standing the highway, man. Standing parked on the road. Down standing the highway, man. Parked on the road. You better watch out for the red light just before you go.
Local favorites like Chester Burnett, the Howlin' Wolf, made records that blacks all over the country bought, and soon Sam was sending tapes not only to Los Angeles, but to Chicago. He got burned one time too often, though, and finally decided that if anybody should be pressing up these great singers, he should be the one. So in 1952, he asked an old high school friend to design him a record label showing a rooster crowing at a rising sun, and Sun Records was born. The first record issued on the label was Blues in My Condition by Jackie Boy and Little Walter, and was supposedly so bad that after testing it out on Memphis radio, Sam withdrew it. But Easy, the song we started with, showed Walter Horton in better shape and sold pretty well. But soon, he had to withdraw another record.
You know what you said about me, don't you, woman? Well, you ain't nothing but a bearcat. Been scratching at my door. You ain't nothing but a bearcat. Been scratching at my door. You can purr, pretty kitty, but I ain't gonna rub you no more.
Rufus Thomas's Bearcat was a straight-ahead copy of Willie Mae Thornton's huge hit Hound Dog, and Sam pulled the song rather than face the lawsuit that got slapped on him. But there was plenty of talent around. Nobody needed to plagiarize anybody else. Sam tried next with Dr. Isaiah Ross, a rural-sounding harmonica player from Tunica, Mississippi. This was too countrified for black buyers outside the South, though, so Sam headed to Beale Street for his next star. Junior Parker was the fastest rising star in Memphis, a veteran of a number of blues bands, including Sonny Boy Williamson's and Howlin' Wolf's. And Sun made him a star with Mystery Train and this classic.
You know, the other day, I was walking down the street. I met a friend of mine. And we stopped and get a little something to eat. When I got to him, I said, "Say, man, look here." He said, "Yeah, Junior, what's happening?" I told him. Well, I feel so good. We're gonna boogie till the break of day. I said, look at here. He said, what is it? Well, the old folks boogie and the children too. Don't nobody boogie like me and you. We're gonna boogie.
Unfortunately, Parker became such a star that he soon signed with another label and went on to stardom elsewhere. By 1954, Sam may well have been disillusioned with blues singers and their inconstancy. He'd started out watching them make money for others, and then he'd raised a crop of his own, only to watch them wander off. Maybe hillbilly singers would be a better bet, he decided, and set about recording some of them. And yet, as he often told Marion Keisker, his secretary, if he could only find a white boy with the Negro sound and feel... Little did Sam know that he'd find him soon, and that one of the first things he'd want to record would be Junior Parker's old Sun Blues hit, Mystery Train.
Train I ride, 16 coaches long. Train I ride, 16 coaches long. Well, that long black train.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, the Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. Many of the old Sun blues recordings can be heard on two new reissues on the Rounder label, Cadillac Daddy and Sun Harmonica Classics. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Canadian-born journalist Robert McNeil. Since 1976, he and Jim Lehrer have co-hosted a nightly news program on public television. Each has also found time to pursue other writing projects. Lehrer has written novels and plays. McNeil's fascination with language led him to co-write and narrate the 9-part public television series The Story of English. The series traced the history and evolution of the English language. His new book is a memoir called Wordstruck. McNeil says he intended to write a book about the pleasures of language, but soon realized that the story of his childhood was closely linked to his interest in language. McNeil's previous memoir, The Right Place at the Right Time, was a collection of career stories. McNeil says that he purposely kept his distance when writing that book. I asked him if he was comfortable now with revealing more about his personal life.
A little. It comes out gradually. It's not given to my personality type to be very revealing, I think, about personal stuff, except with close friends. It's why I would have made a bad actor, a fact I was lucky enough to discover, as you probably noticed in the book, quite early in life.
Well, yeah, you talk about how you'd gone to New York just to try to be an actor.
Yeah, right.
And suddenly a voice in your head said, you want to say what that voice said?
Well, it said you'd make a lousy actor. You know, you're too contained and you're not very demonstrative. I was lucky to have that voice speak to me so sharply, and I believed it. And it said, you know, you're meant to be the cool one behind the scenes, the writer or something, so...
And that's how you became a... You decided you were too stiff to act and that your calling was to write.
Yeah. Well, of course, a lot of people would probably consider that I'm too stiff to be a broadcaster, too, certainly.
Well, you know, as a journalist, you have to really care about accuracy. I think accuracy has a different meaning when you're talking about memory, which is part of what you're dealing
that's,
in
that's
your
a,
new book.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point, yeah. The memories in that book are as true... as they can be. In other words, they are perfectly accurate emotionally, and I haven't doctored them at all, except to edit and leave some things out, but they are as my heart remembers them, you know, as well as my mind.
You have, as a journalist, worked in Canada, England, and the United States. Mm-hmm. Do you think you've picked up different pronunciations and expressions in each of the countries you've worked in?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Some of them have been conscious. When I find an expression I like, I love playing with it and using it. And, you know, I lived and worked 16 years in Britain in two long batches. And I picked up a lot of British idiom. So I surprise and astonish some of my colleagues on the NewsHour when I use an expression like, well, that'll put the cat among the pigeons, which I think is a wonderfully graphic expression for causing trouble, and a good deal nicer than whatever it is hits the fan in the current American idiom. But I do that all the time. And sometimes I lose my ear for it.
In your memoir, you write that your background and your interests put you well out of the stream of popular culture. You talked like a book.
Yeah. Well, I did. I was a snotty little kid. Plummet with a plummy voice. You know, I had sung in a cathedral choir. I fancied myself as an actor doing a lot of Shakespeare when I was in my late teens and early 20s. And where it particularly became obvious to me was when I was hired as an all-night disc jockey in a small commercial radio station, which was, after having been an actor in the radio, my first sort of real job, certainly as an announcer. And I not only didn't know any of the patter and didn't know any of the music, because my interests were really in classical music, but I was very far away from easily using the vernacular that these disc jockeys used. So I don't know what to say, so I would steal some of their phrases, and I'd try and sound like them when they said, and now Les Brown and his band of renown. And it just all sounded kind of really phony coming out of my lips.
Well, on your first late night show, you used to read poetry in the middle of classical music records.
Yeah, because I didn't know anything about pop music, and around about 2 a.m, when I hoped everybody had gone to bed, I would, except for a few people, I'd do that. Yeah.
In your memoir, you write that as a kid, you didn't listen to the news; you heard it in the background, like the Metropolitan Opera broadcast. What brought news to the foreground?
I don't think it came into the foreground until I became a journalist. I really did not. I was so bound up in the theater and in writing that I paid only the most fleeting attention. No story ever really grabbed me very much. I'm very bound up in my own affairs until I became a journalist. Really, I guess until I went to work on Reuters' desk in London in 1955, when I was in my middle 20s. It was only then I really became interested in news.
Did you ever have to cover up for the fact that early on you weren't a news hound?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I sure did. And I had none of the attributes. The attributes of a good news person came to me very gradually, and I acquired some of them very painfully. Like I was extremely reluctant and shy to accost somebody or knock on their door or to phone them up and bother them. And I still am to a degree, but it was just not part of my. I was not in that way aggressive.
Did you become aggressive, more aggressive?
Oh, sure.
Later
well,
on?
you learn professional aggression. I think you can't survive. I mean, I don't mean that I didn't have ambition, and you know, when you're in a certain kind of work, you do what's necessary to do that and do it well, or you get out and do something else. But no, I found I could become more aggressive.
Do you ever get letters from your viewers criticizing the way you speak?
Sure. Oh, sure.
Because you made a grammatical error in a question you asked?
All the time. I think every broadcaster does. And I have to steel myself, because there's something in me that gives me an instant of anger when somebody picks me up on something. And part of it's, oh, damn, did I really do that? Or, are they really right? Am I wrong? You know, I just a little resistance to being criticized, and then I realize that they're probably right. But there, a lot of what I get picked up on are variants of pronunciation or usage, and people are so right when they think they're right. You know, that you are absolutely wrong. I can't think of an example now, but our language is very, very personal to us. And there is, in all of us, I think, an ability to feel that it isn't just that word we used which is being criticized, but criticism of even one word in our usage or a phrase really means criticism of something much more, what they're really getting at or implying, or I infer they are implying, they're getting at an attack on one's whole culture, education, background, whatever. And it's hard to isolate and be objective about it and say, well, that person's just being helpful. Of course, most correcting in language is showing off in one way. It's and this is part of my beef with the sort of language, self-appointed language police, which is one of the, whose existence and behavior is one of the reasons I think why people are turned off about language today and don't realize they can find as much pleasure in it as they possibly could, because there's a kind of snobbish school of language critics who operate a kind of put-down industry and make people feel insecure and negative and unsure of themselves.
Since we're talking about language, I'd like to end with a question about your name. Some people call you Robert, some people call you Robin. Which is the name, which is the nickname?
Robert is the given name, mm-hmm. and Robin was my nickname. And when I was a small boy in Canada, Robin was a nickname or a name given to boys, and it hadn't yet become a girl's name.
And how do you decide which one you're going to use and with who?
Well, I just use Robert as my professional name, but anybody who knows me calls me Robin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very confusing.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about language and about yourself. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Robert McNeil co-hosts the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour, seen nightly on public television. His new memoir, Wordstruck, is published by Viking. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. How are you?
What do you have tonight?
Well, we'll have a report from Nina Totenberg on the Oliver North trial, where Robert McFarlane was on the stand again today, the former National Security Advisor. And evidently, his testimony today turned into a very emotional scene. We'll be hearing about that from Nina. Also, we'll be hearing from novelist Anita Desai, whose latest novel is called Baumgartner's Bombay. She's an Indian novelist who now lives in Massachusetts, and we'll be talking also about the Salman Rushdie affair with her. And we'll be hearing about Butterfly McQueen from Gone with the Wind. Verda Mae Grosvenor will be telling us about what's happened to her since.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In Nicaragua are a matter of almost constant debate in Congress, in communities, and on editorial pages. Anthony Lake, a former American diplomat and government official, has written a new book called Somoza Falling. It's an insider's account of how our government reacted to the fall of Nicaraguan dictator Anastasio Somoza. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Remember the booklet, A Bill Becomes a Law? Many of us studied it in school, a nifty narrative of the salmon-like upstream swimming of legislation through the relevant House and Senate committees to the floor of Congress to the desk of the president. If memory serves, it was also made into a children's TV cartoon with a catchy jingle. Anthony Lake's Somoza Falling reminds me of A Bill Becomes a Law. It might have been called A Policy Becomes a Shambles. Lake rose through the Foreign Service to become director of policy planning in Jimmy Carter's State Department. He's now in exile, a Mount Holyoke professor of international relations. But he was in Washington in 1978, when Nicaragua fell apart after 30 years of Somoza dictatorship. He wants us to know, minute by minute, meeting by meeting, backstab by backstab, how we muddled our way to fiasco, how career diplomats reached an adjournment of minds with political appointees, how human rights activists were at odds with area specialists, and the National Security Council at cross-purposes with state, how congressmen and lobbyists had axes to grind, how practicalities of domestic politics messed with the principle of non-interference in the affairs of other nations. While all this went on, under geological layers of paperwork and the heavy weather of personalities that huffed and puffed and sent down lightning, the Sandinistas were busy winning their revolution and cared not a whit what we said or did, unless we chose to play superpower hardball, invade Nicaragua for the third time in this century, and have another Vietnam or Afghanistan. About Somoza Falling, I should say first that it's elegantly written. So accustomed are we to prose from Foggy Bottom, reading as if garbled from the Quechua, an unwritten language of the Andes, that we forget just how well a Kennan, an Acheson, even a Kissinger could write when safely out of office. It's also unfailingly fascinating, not only on the indoor plumbing of bureaucracy and why it clogs, but on the dreary landscape of exalted thought itself, the plastic veneer tables round which decision-makers crowd for kneesies and vituperation. I suspect Lake, were he not ambitious to return to power in a future Democratic administration, would have been equally Dickensian in his portraits of these difficult people, wound up like toys with keys in their backs. Finally, his suggestions to improve state make sense. A better deal for career diplomats. More attention paid to area experts who know something about the region we're trying to destabilize. And a livelier sense of history, especially Third World history, on the part of bureaucrats who don't take the time to read anything but their own internal memos. I have these caveats, however. Lake seems to suggest that Nicaragua is another Cuba, in spite of its mixed economy, no shooting of political prisoners, and a noisy opposition press. Just maybe Nicaragua got the revolution it deserved, at least from a Nicaraguan point of view. And maybe state and our presidents are always so surprised, though nobody else is, by revolutions in Latin America, Iran, and the Philippines, because they don't get up from their plastic veneer tables and peek out the windows, Lake says, look only down, not far and wide, and try to see some broad new definition of our national interest, generous enough to include the inconvenient aspirations of all the non-American peoples of the world.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Somoza Falling by Anthony Lake. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Novelist Joseph Skvoretsky lived in Czechoslovakia during the Nazi occupation and then under Soviet rule. Neither government tolerated the jazz music and pop novel Skvoretsky loved. His own first novel was banned by the Soviets. Now Skvoretsky lives in exile in Canada, where he writes and teaches and runs his own publishing house. We meet him on the next Fresh Air. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a newly reissued recording of the late pianist Glenn Gould playing Haydn's last six piano sonatas. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg reviews a new video version of Strunken White's The Elements of Style, featuring CBS newsman Charles Osgood. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton, who also directed today's show. Research assistance from Christopher Cook and Peter Murdoch. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.